Managers routinely report that it seems impossible to get through to problem employees. One frustrated manager said to me in a recent conference, "I've told him 100 times, and he just doesn't seem to hear or even want to hear." How can you reach these people? Normally, we learn from our experiences. When people frown at us for inappropriate behavior, they communicate that they think we ought to change, and we tend to avoid that behavior in the future. When people smile at us in appreciation for something we've done, we tend to repeat that behavior, largely through the feedback we receive from others. The capability of the human mind to redirect behavior based on external feedback pays off for us in our approaches to boss, workmates, and life situations in general. While problem employees also receive these feedback signals, messages, and vibes, they are perceptually deficient. They either don't understand the implication of these feedback signals, or they somehow block out their meaning. This brings us to an interesting debate. Are the same kinds of counseling approaches that are part of normal communication really appropriate for the problem person? The whole idea that we can change behavior by simply providing more feedback is based on the assumption that the people being counseled want to change or are capable of change if only they had adequate information. But if problem employees have communication and perceptual problems that are beyond the ability of most managers to handle, maybe communication should be dismissed as a strategy for dealing with these people. A number of studies suggest that the supervisor does have a better chance of changing behavior by arranging consequences, for example, loss of pay, time off from work, or threat of termination. By spelling out the consequences rather than relying on communication methods, the supervisor is more likely to reach the problem worker. It's amazing how certain types of messages do get through. My own belief, based on the evidence, is that the latter approach is probably more likely to do the trick than giving the person a talking to. This is not to say there is no value in counseling techniques, and certainly an understanding of some of the major principles underlying human communication may be helpful. A review of the essentials will give the manager an opportunity to check his own approach to the person. For those managers who have lost faith in communication principles as they apply to problem people, let me assure you that even though communication methods have only a limited ability to change behavior, they have great power to help you get information to diagnose the problem. Gaining some meaningful insights can enable you to decide with greater confidence just what you're going to do with this person. In counseling, what matters most is the extent of our ability to make a connection with the person. As a practical matter, quit trying to figure out what's going on in the other person's head, and don't worry about assigning psychological labels. What matters is that the other person feels a connection to you. Another general pattern found in cases where a therapist got through to patients was that the patients found the therapist empathetic, understanding, and trustworthy. If the patients believed the therapist was working in their best interest and trusted the therapist, the patients were then able to utilize the skills of their trained professional helper to achieve better life adjustments. What all this means is that whether trained as a therapist or not, any person who is perceived by a troubled party as trustworthy has a much higher probability of actually being helpful. That means that a spouse, a good friend, a pastor, a boss, anyone who is able to establish a connection with the person needing help can often be of assistance. Now, when the problem employee is truly emotionally disturbed, you may be in over your head. But on the other hand, supervisors don't have to be psychotherapists to be able to get problem employees to reach out for a better adjustment in their lives. Remember, if the employee perceives that you do care and there is a bond between you, then there is some possibility that that employee may be able to cross that bridge back to you and to better behavior. If that bond is there, or if it can be created, then counseling may be a useful approach to salvaging this person. To that end, think about your communication stance. What is it? Do you respond passively to a problem situation by simply withholding feedback? Do you avoid the employee or talk about the employee to others? Mature managers deal with a problem situation in a business-like fashion. You have a perfect right to speak up and to help the troubled person understand the situation as it is. To fail to speak up in a positive way is a dereliction of duty. At the other end of the scale is the aggressive supervisor who, with hostility and anger, berates employees repeatedly. He attributes all kinds of negative motivations and beliefs to them, rips them apart, tears them down, chews them up, and spits them out. The hostile supervisor is overreacting, perhaps out of his own insecurities, or even because of a need for power. Power in management is not the ability to yell at somebody and get away with it. True power is the ability to get results through people by dealing with them respectfully. Like passivity, aggressiveness isn't going to establish the kind of supportive relationship and effective feedback that will help problem employees change. It's only going to drive them further away, and it gives them a justification for continuing their inappropriate behavior. And so assertive communication is neither passive nor aggressive. It is open, honest, forthright, and to the point. It operates out of respect for the other person and a belief that the other may want to take some action to change. So be assertive and direct in your communications. You have nothing to apologize for, nothing to be afraid of. Looking at the way we communicate will help make us more effective with our employees. When one examines a model of communications, it includes a message sender and a message receiver. In turn, each receiver becomes a sender, and it is the cycling back and forth of information that creates communication. But communication is more than just the sending and receiving of messages. Communication has as its root word the word unity. To have communication, or community, or communion, is to have co-unity, oneness with the other. Communication problems can be caused by the inability of the sender to get his or her message through to the receiver. There are three types of barriers: those that are internal to the sender, those that are in the situational environment between the sender and the receiver, and those that are within the receiver. Understanding the nature of these barriers can help you determine what needs to be done in order to get through to unresponsive people. Let's start by taking a look at the barriers that exist within the supervisor. There are 8 major barriers to communication that can affect the manager's ability to get his or her own message out.
Barrier number 1, lack of confidence.
Managers simply don't use problem employee counseling skills on a frequent basis, and therefore they're often unsure of themselves. Because of this, they're preoccupied with how they're conducting the counseling session, rather than being focused on the person and his problems.
Barrier number 2, bias and prejudice.
We all are victims of our own views of the world. Bias and prejudice need not be powerfully negative and obvious forces. They can be only subconscious and subtly influencing. One of the most common difficulties that a manager has to deal with in confronting a problem employee is the manager's own internalized values about achievement, the need to do things correctly and with excellence, and so on. The fact is that many people don't see their work with the same kind of dedication that a good manager has. And within certain bounds, it doesn't make sense for a manager to look askance at people who aren't guided by the same values at work that he is.
Barrier number 3, the perceptual set.
You can't tell a book by its cover, but many managers try to when it comes to people. We tend to judge by people's surface cues rather than looking deeper. When we're dealing with a problem employee, we sometimes lose sight of the wholeness of this human being and deal only with his most readily visible problem.
Barrier number 4, impulsiveness and premature judgment.
When we like people and approve of them, we tend to think positively of nearly everything that they do. In like fashion, if we have a bad impression of people, we tend to judge negatively everything that they do. This is sometimes called the halo or horns effect. We see them at one extreme or the other, wearing either a halo or horns.
Barrier number 5, poor counseling skills.
It's not uncommon for managers to be unable to effectively counsel employees. They ask the wrong questions, they don't listen carefully, or they become defensive during the communication process. They contribute to poor communications.
Barrier number 6, failure to listen with a third ear.
In this area, I formulated 2 rules for communication. Whatever I say it is, it isn't. And whatever I say it is, there is always more. People never tell you the whole story. They tell you part of the story. Thus, whatever I say it is, there is always more. In like fashion, if we're reluctant to reveal the truth of the situation, we sometimes give surface reasons but not the underlying explanation. Thus, whatever I say it is, it isn't. We are so clever that we manage to speak in ways that do not communicate. One clue to whether other people have more to say is to look at their body language. Does the way they carry themselves say they're tense, open, relaxed, or edgy? To what degree do they make eye contact, and so forth? While the ability to listen to what a person says is certainly important, the ability to listen to a person with the third ear, to listen between the words, to hear messages that aren't even spoken, is also a critical skill.
Barrier number 7, failure to recognize the arc of distortion.
The arc of distortion is a label that has been pinned on the normal distortion effects that occur with language. This phenomenon is nicely captured in the following saying. I know you believe you understand what you thought I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. Because supervisors are generally good with language skills, they often don't see the limits of those skills.
Barrier number 8, distracting behaviors.
Distracting behaviors are the final internal barrier supervisors might have. Managers themselves are sometimes a source of distracting behavior. Some managers, without realizing it, will frown or tap their pencil nervously. They might send facial signals that say to the other person, I don't believe you, I don't have time for you, I don't want to hear this. The inability to listen openly and non-judgmentally creates a barrier to the communication process. There are also barriers in the environment that we need to be aware of. Controlling communication barriers within ourselves is probably more difficult than controlling those in the external environment. Therefore, a cardinal rule in communications management is to minimize the environmental interruptions and work to overcome factors that can hamper understanding. These include 1, background noise and fishbowl communication. The counseling discussion should always take place in a closed office. Hold telephone calls and prevent other disruptions. If there are windows or clear partitions between offices, the participants should face away from them so that other people can't see facial expressions. 2, belief in the mechanistic communication fallacy. Managers who say, I've told this guy 100 times, assume that the person is deliberately disobeying. The fact is that words said are not necessarily words received. How you send a message to another person and your selection of words become very important. Did you know that the 500 most commonly used words in the English language have a total of 20,000 different dictionary meanings? That means that every time you use one of these words, the other person has to pick out the one meaning that you intended from the 400 meanings on average that it has. Environmental barrier number 3 is the use of emotionally charged or incomprehensible language. Language is a mechanism by which we send our communication arrow toward the other person's target, has words that create emotional responses. These include things like profanity, racial labels, chauvinistic expressions, and more. The other problem is that even if we can avoid using words that deliberately provoke negative reactions, we're faced with the fact that other people may simply have vocabulary limitations. managers typically have more education than their employees. Unintentionally, they may be choosing terminology that is simply not going to be understood by the employee. All of these findings simply suggest that we should confine ourselves to common, everyday words, speak simply, speak as we would be spoken to, keep messages short, keep asking for feedback. Did you understand what I said? Do you have any questions about what I've said? Would you please rephrase or repeat what I've said? And keep working at it. If you've already told them 100 times, then it simply means now you have to tell them for the 101st time. Not only do barriers exist in the manager and in the communication environment, they also exist in the employee, and these latter barriers are perhaps the most important of all to penetrate.
Employee barrier number one, emotional factors.
Employees report feelings of fear, anxiety, and insecurity in counseling situations. They often exhibit low self-confidence, many of them all too painfully aware that they are not meeting expectations. That kind of emotional state is hardly conducive to engaging in a meaningful dialogue.
Employee barrier number two, power differential.
Employees are in a situation where they're dealing with an authority figure. They perceive their own power and authority as being very limited. No matter how you look at it, it is the boss who has the power. Even in a situation where the employee is a union member, his or her power relationship with the supervisor is an uncertain one.
Employee barrier number three, lack of candor.
Like everyone else, employees have been conditioned to conceal their true feelings and attitudes. They live behind a mask.
Employee barrier number four, lack of receptivity.
Ability to communicate can also be limited by his endurance. Because of fatigue, it's more difficult for them to discuss things after working a 10-hour shift. So if you can talk with employees when they're fresh and better able to receive your message, it may help. While the manager can eliminate or reduce some of the communication barriers, particularly those in the environment and in himself, there's a limit to what the manager can accomplish in terms of a barrier reduction strategy. A second and better strategy can be tried. Set up the situation so the employee comes across the barriers to you. Let the employee do the work of getting through the barriers. And it's precisely with this approach that the use of good questioning and listening skills becomes important. In essence, a question is an invitation for the employee to overcome the barriers in order to reach the manager. There are some definite questioning and listening techniques you can use. First, make sure you do a minimum of talking. This allows the employee to air his concerns. And second, listening and asking questions will allow you to fine-tune your view of what's happening and improves your diagnosis of the situation. Asking questions sends an I want to know signal. Asking questions and listening for responses draws an employee in. It makes him feel less distant. To ask questions and then to listen is to indicate acceptance of the employee as a person, even if the manager rejects his behavior. One very useful format for using questioning skills is to run the funnel. Running the funnel means to start with questions that are very broad and open, very non-directive, and then to gradually narrow your questioning down to the specifics. The process of running the funnel involves 4 types of questions. First is broad information gathering questions. A suggested technique is to start each counseling session with the phrase, "Tell me about." The phrase, "Tell me about," is both an invitation and a command.
Tell me about why you're late this morning. Tell me about what's been going on with you lately.
This sort of question is so broad that the employee can go in any direction and tell you about any piece of the puzzle. You should listen carefully because how the employee decides to start telling the story can shed considerable light on his thought processes. In a sense, the manager is saying to the person, "Paint me a picture." Just as a painter could start either with trees and clouds or with some of the human figures in the foreground, so it is in a manager-employee counseling session. Some employees will go directly to a discussion of the figures in the foreground, while others will tend to talk about the bushes at the edge of the scene. Those who start on the periphery are not to be criticized. It's simply an indication that they are unable, at least immediately, to deal with some of the more central elements of the picture. The second type of question in running the funnel is the open-ended question. The basic interrogative or question words in the English language will teach you most of what you need to know about any problem situation. They are what, where, why, when, how, and who. The best way to learn is to ask a question. And as the employee paints the picture of what's going on, you can direct him to fill in different areas of the canvas.
What happened then? Who else was involved? When did this occur? Where were you at the time?
All these are open-ended questions. A close-ended question is one that can be answered with a simple yes or no. The problem with close-ended questions is that they don't prompt the subordinate to offer any additional information, and the supervisor may have to lead the employee question by question.
Have you been coming in late every day? Do you intend to correct this behavior? Am I going to have to discipline you?
Another problem with close-ended questions is that they can elicit terribly misleading information. No matter how you answer, "Have you stopped selling drugs yet?" you lose. Open-ended questions cannot be answered with a simple yes or no. They have to be answered with some description. While it takes only a few seconds to ask such questions, it requires far more time to answer them. In this series of questions, the employee with the supervisor's assistance completes the outline of the painting. Step 3 in running the funnel is to use detailed, specific questions. These questions go after fine points not cleared up by the basic inquiries. They may include some yes-no questions and in other ways elicit additional detailed information.
Did this happen before or after Joe pushed you? Were you here at 8:15 or 8:25?
Notice how far down the funnel the questioning has come and how extremely specific the questions have become. In addition to being at the bottom of the funnel, we are also at the point of having the picture fully sketched in. But the picture at this point is still only in black and white. To gain the color, we need our fourth type of question. These are self-evaluation questions. Emotion is the color of life. When we're mad, we see red. When we're depressed, we're blue. When we feel energetic, the color is green for go. By running the funnel, the picture has been painted. Now the manager needs to ask some questions about how the person evaluates the situation that he's described.
As you see it, Fred, what does all this mean? How did you feel when Lisa said that to you?
At this point, the employee's description of his mood, feelings, and emotional reactions will provide a very helpful clue. It is here that the color is added to the picture. Note that the emotional questions can only be addressed after the funnel has been run. After going through the process, the employee feels inclined to trust the supervisor with that information. On the other hand, if the supervisor had started the conversation by asking about the employee's emotional state, the employee would likely have clammed up. While the levels of questioning represent a funneling process or a process comparable to that of painting a picture, listening skills can best be likened to a process of greasing the slide. Listening responses are necessary during the running of the funnel. These do not occur in any order, but are comprised of three types. 1. Restating and rephrasing. This technique is sometimes called mirror listening. You take what you've heard, rephrase it, and say it back to the person.
Let me see if I've got this straight. In other words, you felt that this was the way it happened. It wasn't the money so much as the lack of being recognized for the work you did that got you upset.
When you echo the employee, what you're doing is holding up a version of the picture he has painted or a portion of that picture and saying,
"This is what I've received as you were sending me the message. Do I have this picture right?"
This paraphrasing technique allows the other person to confirm or correct your understanding of his communication. It also sends a message that indicates, "I'm trying to understand what you're saying." The second listening response deals with encouraging responses. These are not designed to actually interrupt the flow. The conversational ball must remain in the employee's court. He is communicating, but he needs a little encouragement to go on. In this situation, the following types of remarks can be helpful.
Uh-huh. Go on. Tell me more. I see. What happened next? Really? I understand.
These brief comments imply understanding. They do not indicate agreement, but are said as a normal courtesy and let the other know that he is being encouraged to continue. In our culture, a fundamental rule of communication is that we should only speak to another person for a limited period of time, usually not more than a couple of minutes, before we allow that person to say something in return. If we do not provide these encouraging, go-on comments, most employees will stop speaking. The temptation for the supervisor at that point is to start speaking, and at that moment, the important objectives of counseling will have been lost, the venting and diagnosis we most want to accomplish. By the use of these encouraging comments, the supervisor is sending a signal. I'm understanding you, and while I'm inserting a brief comment just now, I do want you to continue with the flow of what you're trying to communicate to me. Keep the ball in their court. Finally, good listening involves silence. It's been noted that since we have two ears and one mouth, that suggests a ratio. Silence is a powerful listening skill, in that it eloquently communicates that we want the other person to continue and that we are impressed with what he has said. When the employee comes to the end of his message, you could respond by simply remaining silent. Perhaps nod your head or look interested. These pregnant pauses are probably most appropriate when the employee has said something quite weighty or has expressed a strong emotion. At such times, silence can be a signal of respect. What you have said so impresses me that I don't know what to say. Silence creates a vacuum, and as the seconds quickly pass, it tends to force the person to start talking again. Because people follow Sherman's law that whatever I say it is, there is always more, we know that they will often keep back the part of their story that is most sensitive. If the supervisor will maintain silence at the appropriate moment, with a look of openness and receptivity to what the employee is saying, there is a good chance that the employee will start speaking. It may take as long as 15 seconds, but usually no longer, for the conversation to resume. And conversation will only help both of you in the venting and diagnosis process that leads to resolution.